Looking to step up your Mother's Day flowers? The Home Depot has an idea. Let Mom's green thumb do some digging with colorful flowers, pots, and premium soils to bring out the most in her patios, walkways, and gardens. Right now, get Vigoro Potting Soil, just $8.97 for strong, healthy, vibrant plants indoors and outside. Shop our wide selection online and pick up your order in-store and give Mom the gift of a beautiful garden. Get Vigoro Potting Soil, just $8.97 at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
You're listening to 100 Words or Less with Ray Harkins.
What is happening, everybody? Welcome to another episode of this podcast in which we talk to people who are involved in independent music, whether that's creating it, documenting it, whatever that we decide to do when we get into this whole DIY thing and we feel so compelled to shape the world around our vision and being like, I want to do this. I'm not asking permission. I'm just kind of putting it out there. And then that impacts the world in a really cool and great way. And this person's art has impacted me greatly. I have Matt LaForge, the guitarist for the incredible Toronto or the greater Ontario area hardcore band called Milspec. Spoiler alert, I have their record Marathon in my top 10 of 2023 list, which we will be publishing next week. I know it's a hotly anticipated episode that myself, my friend Joey Cahill, and my friend Jeremy Bolm. We always do that because we've been doing it for, 20 years? I don't know. We've been talking about records for a very long time. Regardless, Matt and the band Milspec are interesting because, like, they're not super active on social media or active at all. And so Milspec exists in this world where it's like, if you know, you know. And of course, there's an air of, you know, cool factor that obviously rubs off on. But when I was thinking about having someone from Milspec on, I was like, where do I even begin? Anyways, good friend of the show, Joey Cahill, comes to the rescue and is like, here, I can, you know, connect with, Greg from Lockin' Out, et cetera, because Lockin' Out is where they put out records on. Anyways, so I hit Matt up, and then lo and behold, Matt and I connected many moons ago when we were talking about podcasts or other things in my professional life. And it was funny because then he reminded me and I was like, oh, dude, I totally remember that conversation. I had no idea that you were, you know, a hardcore kid or in Milspec for that matter. But anyways, this is a great discussion. And he's just an incredibly thoughtful dude. And I had a great time with this. So you can email the show, 100wordspodcast@gmail.com. Always appreciate the feedback and just, you know, general correspondence. Always love that. You can also leave a rating and review on the Apple Podcast page. I do get questions occasionally in regards to how you can support the show. That's all I ask you to do. We'll never ask you to spend money on this thing. The only thing I'll ask you to do is support the advertisers and obviously leave a rating and review. You can also leave a rating on the Spotify page as well. All of those things help the show's discoverability and ultimately showcases why this needs to be in certain people's ears. So all of those things are how you can support the show. I'm incredibly excited because I get to go to For the Children Festival. And for those that are uninitiated or unaware, it's happening this coming weekend in the greater Los Angeles area. The SOS Productions, which is a brainchild of Nate from Zabalba and many other people. But it's an unbelievable event because not only do they have incredible bands like Scowl, Movements, I'm trying to think of some of the other headliners, Beyond Repair, which is obviously, you know, OG Throwdown. Anyways, a ton of great bands. But the whole premise of the show is the fact that you need to obviously bring a toy. When I say obviously, it's like you look at the flyer and they could not make it more clear. But it just benefits this amazing, amazing organization where basically they take all the toys, donate it to kids in need. And I know that sounds like a very sort of basic thing that most, you know, churches and other places do around this time. But to watch like the hardcore scene really pour back that love and that appreciation for the communal aspect, not only of obviously us gathering in a place to watch bands, but just the fact that this can also make an impact on the community at large. I just love this event and I love what they're doing. So I'm excited to go this year, and that's what's happening. And yeah, let's dive into the conversation with Matt from MilSpec. I mean, I was aware of MilSpec, but I really did not like completely get grabbed by what you guys were doing until World House. Like, I just, you know, was like, okay, like they're a cool band. Like, I check out like literally almost everything from the Southern Ontario area. Just have a large affinity for any style of hardcore that comes out of there. And it seems like, and you can obviously probably, you know, feel maybe people paying attention to you more around the release of that record. But it seems like that's kind of when people were like, oh, like they've either found their sound or like they've matured into it or whatever you want to, you know, journalistically call it. Do you think it was just a, you know, a nature of like being able to do what you guys did as any normal band does, where it's like you continue to put out releases and write and all that stuff to get closer to the sound that you were trying to achieve?
Yeah, it definitely went that way. It's hard to know for sure whether there was a real market increase in listenership or anything like that, or an interest at that point, because, well, for one thing, it came out during the pandemic. It came out September 2020.
Yep.
It was supposed to have come out earlier that spring. And so, you know, we were releasing it in this void. I did some interviews with a couple of people on the occasion of the release. And I talked about this, like when you're in a lot of bands will know what I'm talking about. When you were releasing records back then, you had really no idea, you know, you were fully in the simulacrum of social media, which we don't even really participate in. So finding sort of feedback touch points and getting your finger on the pulse of who actually was paying legitimate attention and how much the thing was connecting or resonating was really hard to do. And that was in contrast to 2 years earlier when we had done the 7-inch, the change of 7-inch, where we got a lot more real world feedback. And we definitely detected since, actually, not at the time, but since we sort of detected that there was a little bit of a split in the in people who followed our band between the kind of the 7-inch loyalists and kind of new people who came in for that first LP, which always happens. You know, there were always the 7-inch and demo loyalists. But I think that there were a lot of people who did, yeah, who would put it that way, who said that on that LP we kind of found our sound, or we realized, you know, some potential, or we, you know, hit a plateau or a high point on the arc or something. But there are other people who disagreed, I think, or I'm pretty sure, who said, well, they, you know, this is a little bit more, this is too overwrought for me. It's too,
right.
It's too much of an attempt at being at making a polished record. It's not like the 7-inch, which was rougher sounding and a little bit more tossed off in the way that 7-inches always are. There were definitely two views, at least two views, is my point. But I think in terms of raw numbers, yeah, more people listened to World House than had listened to the 7-inch demo. So that probably just indicated that there was just more interest overall. And therefore, just, you know, because of math, more positive feelings toward it in the aggregate.
And also, I think, and I'm sure you've probably gone through this in your own head, where it's like there are so many times where, you know, bands, especially in the hardcore world, where it's like they release an amazing demo or 7-inch and then, like, you know, just gets lost to the ether. And it doesn't mean that your excitement for that particular output doesn't get diminished, but like I almost find myself kind of being like, all right, I'm going to wait till a full length comes out before I really get pop committed to this band, because like I've had my heart broken so many times where I'm like, oh man, like I'm never going to see this band, or I'm never going to like participate beyond just like listening to these four songs or whatever.
Yeah, I'm kind of the same way. You'll hear people say that, you know, punk is a singles thing or punk is an EPs thing. That's another thing I talked about in an interview that I did back then 3 years ago. I can't remember who I told, but I said the same thing. I don't really agree with that. I think I just was conditioned by virtue of my generation at the time I was born to be an album listener and an evaluator of bands on the basis of albums. And so, yeah, it doesn't ever seem like I know what's really what as far as a band goes until there's an LP, and that I sort of judge a band's discography on the basis of the full lengths that they put out, and would probably consider a band that doesn't do any full lengths to be of, you know, in a different category or to be sort of competing in a different arena. But the thing about that record was that it was only 8 songs and we had kind of rushed it into production, as I recall it. I think we sort of felt ourselves going down a path that we ended up definitely going down on the follow-up on Marathon, the record that just came out, where we were getting a little bit too in our heads and we were writing and rewriting and revising and revising. And we could sort of see that kind of lapsing into perpetuity and
sure,
going through the looking glass, and we could see ourselves, you know, not being able to escape that pattern. And I think I was like one of the leaders of the faction of the band that said, we got to just call this. We have to go into the studio with what we have, and we got to actually make this thing, because if we just keep obsessing over what it could be, we'll never actually write it. We'll never actually record it. And in retrospect, I think we all agree that we actually did err on the side of going in a little bit too early because, you know, for one thing, we didn't have a full 10 or 12 songs. We, you know, didn't have a plan for who was going to produce it. There were a few things that we would have done differently if we'd given ourselves more time, but there was a real danger in giving ourselves too much time. So we didn't give ourselves too much time. We gave ourselves too little time, and the results are the results. But I know that it definitely struck a chord with a lot of people. It sounds like you included, which I appreciate. So,
yeah,
you know, we were happy with it. You're happy with it on balance. It's, you know, there's like this sort of parallax effect that you get when you look back at something that's older than the most recent thing you put out, that it's always going to suffer by comparison. I think that's probably generally true, especially if the more recent thing is brand new, which our more recent thing is.
Right.
You can look back at the other thing and be like, well, we didn't, you know, there are a lot of things we did on the latest thing that we should have done on the first thing.
Yeah. Well, and to your point too, there is no external pressure for you guys releasing music. And when I say that, like the pressure is all internal. Like you're not having to be like, oh, we got to put out a record in order to, you know, get back on tour and like participate.
Yeah, there are no stakeholders to satisfy. Yeah.
No, right. Right. And so to that degree, that's exactly what you're talking about, where it's like the only pressure that is being applied is to ourselves. And if we continue to do that, this will just be locked in this, you know, vicious cycle, snake eating its tail scenario, where it's like, dude, it just took us 8 years to have 8 songs. Like, this is terrible. Like we got to be a little quicker than that.
Yeah. And it represented, there was a shift that happened at some point, like maybe 2 or 3 years into the band. Whereas when it was a new band, we were trying to kind of adhere to, you know, like demo core principles of writing quickly, recording quickly, not worrying about how things sounded, you know, being elusive in our songwriting, not caring too much about originality. And then there was a paradigm shift that happened like somewhere around the 7-inch just after it, where we started to get it, you know, started to get it in our heads that we could write good songs. And that was
right,
like a mixed blessing. Like that was, you know, potentially fatal to the band, because once you start to think along those lines, you know, there's no end to the madness that you might pursue. So rushing the production of the first album was an attempt to kind of like keep our heads. And we didn't do as good a job, by the way, of keeping our heads with the second one. We will, you know, every kind of tendency and, you know, mental problem that we were worried about forestalling with the first one kind of came to pass in the second one. But then again, I think the second one's better. So
you got to get the balance right. You do. We'll pull apart some of those threads a little bit later, but I wanted to focus on you as a person. Were you actually born and raised in the, I guess, greater Ontario area, or did you come up somewhere else?
I was born in British Columbia, in the west side of Canada, in the mountains, like a little like logging town in the middle of nowhere. But my parents are from Ontario. They're from the Ottawa area. And that goes back a few generations on both sides. But they were not hippies, but they were, you know, they were doing what a lot of people did in the 60s and 70s and just go west. Happened in the U.S., happened in Canada, like you're young and you're in your 20s and there's work out west, there's, you know, adventure and opportunity out west. So out you go. Then they worked in the oil fields out in Alberta, and they ended up, for reasons that remain a little bit unclear, 43 years later in this little logging town in a little A-frame house in like the foothills of the Kootenai Mountains. And I was born there, was there for a little while, and then came back to the Ottawa area, which, as I say, my family's all hails from, when I was about three. And I grew up not in Toronto where I now live, but near Ottawa.
Okay, got it. And what was the family structure like? Like brothers and sisters? I mean, like you said, mom and dad were present. What did that look like inside the house?
The standard Canadian upbringing. You had two, mom and dad in the house. Both of them worked. A little sister, comfortable house, quiet street. You know, CFL on Sundays. Hockey night in Canada. I was thinking about this. I've heard you ask this question before, so I was trying to prep myself a little bit on how I would answer it. And
absolutely.
How well I did in coming up with something good to say. But one thing that I was thinking about was that, you know, we're going to talk about my exposure to music and stuff like that. And I really credit a lot of the interest I later developed in cultural things, specifically music, to, you know, I think I don't at this stage have a really romantic idea about how that all happened. That might just have to do with my own biography. I didn't have an older brother or sister putting me onto cool stuff. I didn't live in an area where I was going to encounter cool people. I had a very, very, compared to how I live now, rural, early childhood. I didn't live on a farm, but I lived in a farm area.
Sure.
My parents were city kids. My dad had grown up, in Ottawa proper. My mom had two up until she was a little bit older, and both of them actually ended up in a little you know, village outside of Ottawa where they met in high school and moved to, you know, after the sojourn out west, came home and kind of wanted to continue in that vein. They, you know, my dad wanted land. He was in his 20s. He had a lot of energy. He wanted to try raising animals, you know, so we bought some like 16 acre piece of land with a little house on it in the middle of nowhere, surrounded by farms. And my dad built a chicken coop and we had hogs for a while. This is when I'm like 3, 4, 5, 6 years old.
Sure.
I'm like, I can remember going to like barn sales and agricultural fairs on the weekend and like tractor pulls with my dad. Like my dad was he wasn't an agricultural person. He had a construction job, but he was really interested in this, you know, kind of like pursuing this kind of lifestyle. It didn't end up taking, he was too busy. He didn't have the time for it. It didn't make sense for us. And, but you know, there was no, we didn't have, a lot of other kids my age in the area. There certainly was no, you know, anything that you would call a local culture outside of, you know, like, you know, church parties and fiddling.
Sure.
And things like that. Like it was very, very rural. Like it's almost, you know, I look back at my own early childhood and like marvel at how like 4-H it was. And, compared to how things, you know, played out a few years later. Like the next move we made when I was about 7 or 8 was to like a quiet subdivision in, 2-story house that we built, which was very suburban. It wasn't in the suburbs. It was like in an exurban kind of location, but it was sort of a suburban type of lifestyle, suburban kind of house, suburban kind of property. And there, that's when, you know, more media started to come into the picture. We had got cable TV and, you know, we had got a VCR. Before we had the VCR, we were watching video discs. Do you ever watch a video disc? Not a laser disc, but a video disc. It was like,
no, like, I mean, I worked
at, look up this technology. I could remember watching like Superman 2 and like Rodney Dangerfield Back to School on video disc. It came in like, it was like a 12 by 12 or 13 by 13 inch plastic container or cover that had like the movie art on it. My dad would rent the machine that played these things, you know, every 2 or 3 weeks on a Friday, bring it home. Bring it like a box, like a milk crate full of movies. It'd be like, you know, it'd be like Brewster's Millions, Superman 1 and 2.
Sure.
Some Dangerfield movie that he wanted to watch. And you would slide the plastic thing into this, you know, into the front of the machine. You'd hear the sound of the machine sucking the disc in. You'd take the plastic thing out and then you'd watch the movie. I think you had to flip it like a record. It was like, it's very short lived, kind of 8-track-esque. Technology.
Anyway, sure.
That's how we were living, you know, in the period I mentioned before when I was like 3, 4, 5, and then 7, 8, 9, 10 years old. It's a more suburban like existence. There's cable TV, you know, and I can remember that shift really vividly. Like the first thing I remember turning on the TV when I was 12 or something, when we finally got cable, because I knew what I miss was I was missing, and I, you know, I was very excited to get cable after all those years. The first thing that came on when the cable got hooked up and the switch got flipped was like an NBA game, which you never saw in Canada. And I can remember thinking, like, here we go, here comes the tidal wave, you know, like I'm finally going to get, you know, all this stuff is going to crash over me, all this music and sports and movie stuff that I knew was out there and I knew that I was missing was on its way into my house, and as indeed it was, and it kind of, you know, took over my life for up until now.
Right, right. No, I love painting that picture when it's like you start to, it's like, yeah, to your point, if you don't have an older sibling or someone else that's being able to usher you into things, like you're just, you know that there's something like on the other side, but you don't know what that thing is. And then
start the point I was going to make was that I have to credit like the mass media for whatever exposure to whatever cool thing I ended up finding. There's really no escaping it. It's because of like Much Music, the Canadian MTV. It's because of whatever cool thing you might hear on commercial radio. It's because it was because of like seeing, you know, like, watching National Lampoon's Vacation with and hearing Blitzkrieg Bop on the soundtrack or something like that, or seeing the Ramones and the Simpsons, like these little hints that you would see in the kind of the mainstream mass media of the late 80s and early 90s that finally cohere into something, you know, that you can actually figure out or that you can actually get your head around a couple years later. You know, what a big thing was the in terms of getting into punk.
Yep.
I was just telling somebody else about this. Like it had never really occurred to me what the trigger was, because people, you know, want to know, people ask, people talk about that. Like how did, you know, what finally got you on the path to being into punk and hardcore or whatever. And for me, it was like the first side of Incesticide, you know, that the Nirvana collection.
Of course.
Which didn't sound like, you know, side A of Incesticide obviously doesn't sound like their other records, because it's a lot more, you know, that's them doing, you know, punk rock. So the little things like that would just sort of show up through the mass media. And I have to, you know, a lot of people will talk about, like you say, the older brother or the guy who, you know, who wrote graffiti or wrote a skateboard in the neighborhood. I just didn't have that. I was going to have to like piece things together by renting movies and, you know, watching cable TV.
Yeah, no, I love that. And I think too, I mean, because I, if I'm not mistaken, like we're probably same generation, like, you know, roughly around 40. And I think that that was so because we existed as we were coming up with the, you know, pivotal ages of whatever between 8 to 15, like it was such a monoculture era that like any little piece of something that seemed interesting, all you tried to do was just be like, oh, I got to record 120 minutes on VHS, you know, for whatever. Like you just start to find those little fissures, and like, but the only way that that thing would have ever come across our desk is through, to your point, the mass media. And like, that's incredibly important.
Yeah. You would just take this, like, you know, you would take everything in, and then, you know, you'd the dump truck would show up at your house and dump all the culture in your front yard. And then you'd have to go out and pick through it.
Totally.
You know, that's all you did. You spent hours and hours and hours just trying to find something that was actually cool.
Totally. Totally. And I always love that feeling of like, I can't illustrate it better from a picture perspective, the way you described it, just like sifting through garbage, because like you do end up latching on to things that by no stretch of the imagination are quote unquote cool. But because you found it at a certain time, you were just like, no, actually I really like this. And like devoid of context, you're just like, yeah, I'm sorry. I like this, whatever. Like I always look back at like, you know, depending on when you got into the Misfits, it's like, you know, the Michael Graves era, most people are just like, dude, that's trash. But if you got into it, then like, sorry, that's the era that you got into it.
Yeah. Andrew from the singer from Mil-Spec's a big Graves guy. It's true what you say. Like things would come to you from weird directions and from weird sources too. Like I remember the first time I ever heard about rap music. The first time I've ever heard about rap music was like in 1987 or something. And back then, Canada was a much more kind of distinct media environment and popular culture. And back then, even that recently than it is now, just because of the way that the media works, like it was not really the case that you could get everything that would be on American air through, you know, the Canadian media channels. You could get a lot of it, but not all of it. You know, you could get most of the network shows, but not all of them. You'd hear most of the popular music, but not all of it. You'd see most of the movies, but not all of them.
Yep.
That's changed now. You can see everything. But back then, you know, there was certainly no rap radio or hip hop radio where I was from. And there was not much, you know, there was no other real way that you're going to hear about it. So I'm 7 years old and I'm in second grade. And this is how I hear about rap music. There's like some theme day at the school I'm going to. In, you know, grade two, like I say, as we say up here, not second grade.
Nope.
And, yeah. you sign up for some workshops. It was some, you know, it was some like, we don't do school today. We don't do classes today. We're going to do workshops. And one of the ones that I signed up for was this music module called like the basics of rock and roll or something like that, where the idea was these 7 and 8 year old kids, you go to the classroom, kids from all different classes, kids from different ages, and a guest, like a parent volunteer, would come in and write a song with you. And this parent was this guy, Jack Donovan, who was like, you know, like these local pillars of the community, you know, the people who like own the like the auto dealership or, you know, like the hardware store, the grocery store, like the local gentry.
Yep.
You know, like when Trump got elected, people would talk about, oh, it was actually like the snowmobile dealers that elected them. It wasn't the coal miners, like guys like that who are, you know, like real pillars of the community. They sponsor all the teams. You know, they play the organ at the hockey game or, you know, at the football game or something like that. A guy like that. And he had all kinds, like, yeah, I think he did sell cars. I'm not sure what business he was in, but he'd like show up to his son's soccer games. I played on the same team. He'd be wearing a 3-piece suit. Like, my dad got a kick out of this guy. Anyway, he's doing this module because I guess he could play the piano and he had a music sideline. I think he DJ'd weddings and stuff like that. And so we get going. He's like, all right, kids, let's go. Let's write some lyrics. What are you thinking about? And so we write these lyrics. Anyway, long story short, the song that these 7 and 8 year old kids put together has this kind of like talking cadence. He's like, this sounds kind of like a rap song, if you ask me. And that was the first time I had ever heard about rap music. And I go home and I ask my mom what it is and she didn't know. But so, you know, there's like a 6 or 8 or 12 month lag between hearing the term and actually hearing the music. And that was, you know, the next 2 or 3 years of my life, I was obsessed with rap music. And but the kernel of it was planted by this, like, you know, like local clown,
right? you heard the words of it and you're just like,
a guy who sold like farm equipment or something.
Rockabilia.com is a proud sponsor of this podcast and a company that I love dearly because they sell officially licensed merch from all bands of shapes and sizes. Like, I understand we are butting right up against the holidays, so if you want to get an awesome discount on all the gifts that you can potentially buy at rockabilia.com, use the promo code 100 words or less is the promo code, and that gives you 10% off your entire order. And trust me in saying that you will be able to find stuff for your mom, your dad, your brother, your sister. Anybody who's even a casual music fan is going to find something of interest here. And like I said, it's all officially licensed. That means the bands get paid. They ship it from the Midwest here in the United States of America. And I just love the company for what they do. You can have a lot of fun browsing around for gifts, or even if it's just like, yo, I'm going to slide a shirt for myself in there. And that's totally fine. Promo code is 100 words or less, 10% off your entire order. Go shop at rockabilia.com and get all those gifts because time's running out. Let's go. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. We all carry around different things that stress us out, right? Like maybe it's something really, really small, like, man, that parking space, it's always taken. And I wish that I would be able to like get it instead of, you know, this person that maybe, you know, is the most courteous and considerate. I know that's something very random, but it's true. We all experience different things throughout the day that trigger us in so many different ways. And there are many times where I have been like, I wish that I had a spot or a repository for me to, you know, get this stuff off of my chest. Because if you bottle it up, that is no bueno. And then all of a sudden you explode on a coworker or a friend or a family member being like, the parking spot. And people are like, what are you talking about? That is where therapy comes in. And I love working with BetterHelp because I'm a huge advocate for therapy, broadly speaking. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, please give BetterHelp a try. It is so easy because it's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. All you do is fill out a brief questionnaire and then you get matched with a licensed therapist. And if you are not vibing with the therapist for any reason, you can switch it out at no additional charge. Get things off of your chest with BetterHelp. So visit betterhelp.com/ray today to get 10% off of your first month. That's betterhelp.com/ray. So like you said, your progression through, music, like you're articulating through mass media, what kind of kid did you find yourself being, like, you know, sports person, you know, did you like school? I mean, obviously
sports person for sure.
Okay. Got it.
Yeah, I was in a real kind of like a, you know, like I mentioned the guy at the soccer game, like it was very jock town.
Yep.
And the same guy I mentioned was, you know, heavily involved in local like minor hockey and stuff like that. So it was like a real jock kind of town. I wasn't a jock kid because I was too much of a shrinking violet and too shy, and jocks aren't shy and retiring, which I was, but I love sports and I was obsessed with them to this day. Like sports, I'll never be able to quit them. They'll be a part of my life till the day I die, no matter how obnoxious, how stupid, how much of a time suck. And it all started in childhood. So I played hockey, I played baseball, and that was really where my head was at until I guess probably junior high, you know. Mm-hmm. 12, 13. And that's true for a lot of people. Like you kind of have an early childhood that's, you know, maybe not too concerned with culture, that, and that changes once, you know, you get old enough to care about that stuff. And there's all kinds of obvious reasons why you start to care at that age.
Yeah. But
definitely a sports kid, you know, not a distinguished athlete, but perfectly, I was like tall, you know, a tall enough kid, a sturdy enough kid that I was fine, you know. I was able to, you know, I played sports all seasons.
Sure. Until you participated. Right. Right. And so as you started to dive into the more, you know, independent leaning stuff and like going to shows and everything like that, was what attracted you to it? Was it the, you know, simple act of obviously the energy, you know, was what spoke to you?
Well, it took a while. At first I wasn't attracted to it at all. I had real ambivalent feelings about it as a kid. I remember heavy music, loud music, cool music, music that could be coded as dangerous, you know, especially in the '80s. I was fascinated by it as everybody was, but I was also recoiling from it because it just didn't seem to be the kind of thing that like a kid like me would have any business with. Mm-hmm. And I was, you know, I really like rap in the late '80s because I really hated the hair metal of the '80s. Like I really hated it. Like I was like a real kind of like stuffy kind of reactionary about it. I'm like, oh, that's filthy. Like I had this real revulsion towards kind of the guitar music of the '80s.
Sure.
Cause it was, you know, it was like shabby and dirty and, you know, for like, you know, and like, I couldn't understand the kids in my class who, you know, identified with it. I had a really hard time with it. So I gravitated to rap music, which was like verbal and kind of, you know, and from another place and another culture, and it was kind of felt like my own thing. And then when, you know, guitar music started to change, which, you know, has been talked about a million times, but when that started to happen and people kind of in my age cohort circa 1990 or 91, 92 started to move from, you know, Euro dance pop or rap music or like, you know, really, really, you know, commercial rap music back to guitar music because of Nirvana and Pearl Jam and all of that. At first I was really resistant. I'm like, well, this doesn't have anything to do with me. This is like, you know, this is like what cool kids are going to get into. And I'm going to have to, you know, I'm going to have to make other arrangements. So at first I was really, really worried about it. Like I was worried what I was going to do with this kind of guitar music resurgence, because I didn't feel like I was fit to participate. And, but meanwhile, I'm like developing an interest in the music itself. I like it. I'm paying a lot of attention to it. I'm watching the videos. I'm listening to the radio. I know that I like it, and I'm trying to figure out, what am I going to do about this? I like this music, but I'm too much of a dweeb to be part of it, because, you know, it's not for people like me. Like I had this real internal struggle. Mm-hmm. And it got to the point where I remember like the breaking point was when I was in grade 8, I think. It was like the June of 1994, like the end of grade 8 for me, the end of junior high, end of an era. There was, you know, the Doughboys, that Canadian band?
Oh yeah.
From Montreal. They were hot shit at the time in Canada because their major label debut was out, Crush. That's the one with all their big songs on it, you know, Shine, Fix Me, all those songs. And they were big, kind of like, not big stars, but they were like Much Music. They were big Much Music artists. Much Music played them all the time. Much Music would like run contests to like meet the Doughboys, get tickets, get backstage passes, get a plane ticket to go see them in Montreal. Like they were really pushing them as stars on Much Music. Not really on radio, but definitely Much Music. So they were like a known quantity, and they were doing this tour, like a B market tour of Canada, including the hockey arena, like 50 yards away from the elementary school I went to. And of course, everybody in the school is like geek to go. This is, like I say, 94. This kind of music is really cool now. People, even my age, 13, 14, are starting their own bands. Like this is the place to be. And I really want to go, but I remember I just didn't, you know, I just kind of didn't have the guts. I like was desperate to go. And then, you know, I was talking to friends of mine about it. I'm like, should we go? Like, it's going to be kind of sketchy. Like, is it going to be bad? Are we going to get, you know, are people going to beat us up? Is it going to be cool if we go? Like, I just didn't know what to do. I was like really, really torn. A friend of mine wanted to go. I remember the night of, he called me. He's like, are we going to go? And again, like this was 5 minutes away from my house and a stone's throw from my school. Mm-hmm. And I was so torn up about it and didn't know what to do. I remember this. I went out to the backyard of my house and my mom was there gardening. And my mom wasn't too invested in any of this stuff yet because I was too young. But even she could tell what was going on. I remember her saying to me, she's like, I really think you should go to this show.
She's like, stop being so nervous, Matt.
Yeah, that's exactly what it was. Like I was such a, yeah, I was such a like a hand-wringing little like fuss pot of a kid. And I didn't go. I just didn't. I'm just like, no, it's going to be weird. I won't be welcome there. Something bad's going to happen. So I just,
right. Too know, risky.
I was too neurotic to go see the Doughboys at 14 at the local hockey arena, which is like a major regret. But from that point on, I like turned over in relief. I'm like, I can't do this anymore. I have to actually, you know, just admit that I like this shit. And I have to just, you know, try to make, like, I have to participate. I have to start going to these shows. I have to start making friends with these people. I have to start putting myself out there, which I started to do because it just didn't come naturally to me to be like a, you know, to be social in any way. It's really not that way.
Sure. Yeah. I just, yeah, there's so much of that I really, I think many people can identify like that when you always look back with rose colored glasses to your experience, there are so many of those moments that you just like simply forget about where you're just like, oh yeah, like I was actually scared getting pushed into a mosh pit or whatever. It's like, yeah, of course. Like, you know, those are normal feelings. And the idea that like, yeah, I shouldn't go to a sketchy show. Like even at your age, it's like, yeah, of course. Like you shouldn't be hanging out with adults. Like there's so many things that could go wrong.
All the kids in the schoolyard were like, you know, there were, you know, kids that, who are 12 or 13 or 14, like they're such, you know, they're such posers. They're like, oh, we're going to sell fake acid. We're going to, we're going to drink, you know, we're going to like, they're making all these, they're cooking up all of these schemes. And sure. I'm just like in a cold sweat, you know, listening to all these conversations, wondering what am I going to do when I show up at the show and my friends are selling fake acid and they're all drunk or they're all, you know, they're all getting high. Cause I, even at that age, I was, you know, had a real aversion to any of that stuff. So I was like, it was like a panic for weeks and I did the show. I've told people that I went to that show. I've lied about it in like in my adult life. And I can't remember, like, and I'm coming clean now. I didn't go even despite my mom's protestations, despite having friends who are willing to go, despite, you know, living 5 minutes away from the venue. I didn't go see the Doughboys at the, you know, the peak of their powers in my hometown.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's good. I'm glad you can come clean here. When did you start noticing, for lack of a better term, like the local scene, as it were? I mean, I know me being from California, like I became so obsessed with, Chokehold, Grade, Swarm, like basically anything from that area. And I just found it so mesmerizing for me being across the country and feeling like, oh, this is so weird. Like this whole Southern Ontario scene just seems to be having, you know, not just even a moment, but just like seems to be churning out so much stuff. When did you become, I guess, aware of all the stuff that was happening around you?
That probably happened a little bit later because Ottawa, like things were still more regionalized then, even then in the 90s. And sure. Ottawa was a different ecosystem completely. The Ottawa area, you know, like which I was part of, that solar system, was very distinct from the Southern Ontario solar system. You know, there was like enough space between them, you know, like a 4 or 5 hour drive that it was really hard to know, especially if you didn't exactly have your ear to the ground, as was the case with me back then, what was going on then in like the midnight. So the local scene that I became aware of was hyper local. Like I'm talking about the, you know, the high school bands in the little town, like population 5,000 where I went to school. But it was like a flourishing scene. As a lot of those towns were at the time, like the thing to do back then, if you were young, was play in a band. So there was plenty of stuff happening locally that could hold your attention if you were really, really young and just starting to get your bearings. But what did start to happen was national bands would start to come through, like the kids in Elmont, Ontario, which is the name of the town, they booked Propaganda in 95 or 96. They booked, you know, DOA a year or two before that, SNFU. So like that's the kind of thing that started to happen. Like these sort of national bands started to play, you know, 10 minutes from my house. And I did go to those shows. And it was sort of in by a reverse process where the national bands show up that I started to realize what was going on locally. Like around that time, there was another show that I didn't go to that I should have gone to, which was Fugazi, who played with Shotmaker and Okara. Do you know them?
Oh, but dude, Shotmaker is, yeah, just all time. Like, they are such a overlooked band. I mean, I know everybody says this about like every band that existed in the 90s, but like, they for sure. So yeah, I understand what you're
talking
about.
And they were the kings of Ottawa. Like, Ottawa was, you know, that sound, or that kind of, that sound broadly construed, like that Ebullition sound, which they were, you know, they represented a wing of, was like a real, you know, Ottawa was a real citadel for that stuff. You know, like, you know, Santa Barbara was, and Philly was.
Of course. And we got Sean Scallon. Yeah, Sean Scallon,
exactly. And Scallon ran the scene, and Shoutmaker were his boys. But anyway, he did a Fugazi show in 95 that I didn't go to, not because I wussed out in this case, but because I didn't have a ride, didn't have anybody to go with. My friend who I was supposed to go with got, you know, got laid up at football practice the day before or something. So it didn't end up working out. But I bring that up because it was Fugazi who we wanted to go see, but it was Shotmaker and Okara that we found out about. So it probably would have been around then. And it was because of seeing flyers for national bands, both in the city of Ottawa and in the outlying areas. Like I say, bands like Propaganda would play. And then the openers would be, you know, we get put onto the openers who were like the big local players that way. And that was like that was happening in the mid 90s, early high school for me. And it was sort of by that process. And then the next phase was, I was a little resistant to that stuff because the sound wasn't quite right. You know, I was interested in Fugazi because they were such a big deal, but Shotmaker and Okara when I was 15 was just not what I was checking for. It's not the sound I wanted.
No way.
And I think a lot of people our age kind of maybe got caught up in that. Like, it just, that wasn't going to work.
No.
If you were 15 or 16, it was perfect if you were in college. You know, like, if you're 21 and, you know, entering a more pseudo-intellectual period of your life or a headier period of your life, it was perfect. But it was just a little bit too sophisticated for me at that age, a little bit too abstruse. So it didn't connect exactly. And it was, that was, like I say, that was what was popping in Ottawa. Like, that's what was happening locally. It was one of the major centers for it worldwide because of Scallon. Scallon also had a show on local community radio where he would just play that stuff. Like, somebody told me, a friend of mine was just like, oh, you have to listen Monday night, you know, 10 o'clock on CKCU, the Carleton University station. There's this punk show. It's great. You got to listen to it. I tape it every week. I tune in and it's like, you know, Sleepy Time Trio, and it's, you know, it's like Universal Order of Armageddon. It's early His Hero Is Gone. It's just like, I'm like, what the fuck? Like, it's all so crazy. Like, the shit back then was so crazy. It was like the last real, you know, that period was like the last real avant-garde period in some ways for punk. And it was just nothing. Like, it was so non-traditional. It was so, you know, it's so outside of what you expect, outside of genre conventions. It was just, I didn't know what to make of it. So the local scene was like kind of inscrutable to me at that age. So again, I was like relying on national touring bands, like Fat and Epitaph stuff, which I was obsessed with at the time, because the local scene was just too, you know, too heady, too up its own ass. The music was too complicated, you know, too deconstructed. It was, you know, I've come to respect and love all that stuff retrospectively now, but back then, not the right age, not the right time.
No. And honestly, like, I, up until you are saying the comparison between, you know, Ottawa and Santa Barbara here in California, like, I never made that connection, but it's total. I mean, it's so true, because, like, I mean, in Southern California, it definitely was that same vibe, whereas, you know, me coming up in the Orange County hardcore scene or what have you, like, there was definitely a bright line between the idea of, like, watching Yaphet Kotto and watching, like, Throwdown, for obvious reasons, like, sonically. But, like, I could totally see being, you know, immersed in what you were being immersed in, where you're just like, this is way too obtuse. Like, how could I don't understand this. Like, angular guitars, like, where's the punk beats, bro?
Yeah. I don't know what the lyrics are about. You know, like, I mean, I understood that it was like challenging, and then challenging was good. And
totally.
I understand that it was deconstructive, and that was good. I understand it. I understood it to be like, you know, to be kind of like a modernist avant-garde type of project, which was, you know, I credited. But I just, like, on an emotional level, it did nothing for me. It was kind of meant not to do, you know, it was sort of meant to be, you know, operated at a bit of a meta level. Like, it wasn't supposed to make an easy, you know, an emotional appeal. That was the whole point of it. To some of it, you know, some of it was a little bit more, you know, mawkish and sentimental and melodramatic, but a lot of it was, you know, was, you know, the whole point of it was to kind of keep the listener at arm's length emotionally.
Yeah.
And when you're like a 15-year-old who's, you know, you just kind of want easy emotionality in your music a lot of the time. And that wasn't, you know, you're barking up the wrong tree there, but I'm sure it was the same thing. And like in California, what you would have, which we didn't have in Ottawa, you'd have like, you know, you would have traditionalists and old schoolers and badasses kind of holding the line probably by playing in traditional bands or playing in more straightforward bands. And Ottawa was just too small of a scene. Like there was kind of one thing going on at any one time. And when that was going on, there wasn't much of an answer for it locally. So
yeah, it was you didn't have any options. Yeah.
Yeah. You didn't have any options.
Yeah.
So like there was no, like that youth crew stuff that started on the East Coast.
Right.
But revival stuff. And like in around the same time, 95, 96, like it took forever. Like it took me and my friends to make that trickle up to where I was from. It wasn't in the local offering at any level.
Evilgreed.net is a proud sponsor of this podcast, and I am a proud lover of that company. They provide web store solutions for bands and record labels, but you, as the end consumer, benefit from ordering stuff directly from them, from a bunch of band stores. And they have a very curated list of bands. Like, I like to describe it as anything that's sort of like heavy and artistic, that is what they do. But I want to give you a promo code where you can get 10% off your entire order. 100 words. Please apply that at checkout. You will get 10% off of your entire order. And why I love this company. They're based in Berlin, Germany. They ship worldwide. And for us here in the United States, it is a very beneficial exchange rate as of right now. But they work with incredible bands. They work with stuff that is as wide and varied as things that come out on Triple B, things that come out on Sargent House. Like I said, anything heavy and artistic, they traffic in. You know, Power Trip, Blood Incantation, like just trust me in saying you will absolutely love the site and what they do. They can ship you vinyl. They can ship you hoodies, shirts, anything that you are interested in from a lot of those type of bands you will find. So I know in the fact that we are like weeks away or days away from the Christmas holiday, you might be running up against some, you know, last minute gifts. Trust me in saying that if anybody you know likes anything heavy, you will absolutely be able to find a lot of cool stuff at evilgreed.net. So go to the website, use the promo code 100 words, and that gives you 10% off your order. Thank you very much, Evil Greed.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with a king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. That's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
When you started to, you know, witness these bands and watch them play and obviously go to, you know, smaller shows and DIY stuff, did you immediately want to play in a band? Or again, was that kind of something you had to warm up to? Like, or did your mom have to encourage you to play in a band?
Oh yeah. Did the same exact set, same okay. set of neuroses, you know, like I could never play an instrument. I would never even dare, you know, I don't have it. I'm left-handed for one thing. I'm very uncoordinated. Like I would talk myself out of it, like on the front end completely.
Sure.
But what ended up happening was a very close friend of mine who I grew up in, who grew up on my street, Nate, he had a different personality. He was a lot more industrious. He was a lot bolder. He and I were getting into this stuff at the same time. And he did what, you know, more well-adjusted kids do and started to pick things up for himself. Like he immediately started to play guitar and he wanted to put together a band, but it was, like I say, it was a small group of us in this little exurb that we were from and he didn't have a lot of options. Like I'm talking by now, late 90s, and the kind of band he wants to start is, you know, inspired by the, you know, that kind of Youth Crew revival stuff, late 90s stuff, you know, 10 yard fight, floor punch. He wants to do that kind of band. And that's what I like too. And he's got a couple of other people lined up who are, you know, halfway into it. And he's going to write the songs and play guitar, and he's wondering what he's going to do about the frontman situation. And I'm standing right there being like, hey, you know damn well I can't play an instrument. So if there's an opening, I'm qualified
to do
one job only. And so that's what ended up happening. I joined his band as a singer in 98 or so. And I think it was against his better judgment because I didn't, you know, I don't, especially then, I didn't cut the figure of like the Revelation Records straight edge style frontman. Like I was lanky, I was, you know, tall, gangly, I had red hair. Like I didn't have, you know, I didn't have,
the, oh, you didn't have the look,
the right figure. I didn't have the voice, and the look is very important, you know.
Absolutely.
Clearly, my friend Nate was imagining somebody with, like, you know, a prominent brow, a muscular build.
Of course.
You know, like piercing eyes. I didn't have any of those things. So he's like, all right. You know, my voice wasn't that good, but he was a good friend. And he let me do it. And we did that band from that point, like I say, 98-ish to 02, 03. Like it was like a case where the high school band or the late high school band or the early college band goes for way longer than it should. Like it takes.
Sure.
It doesn't break up in 3 months like it should. So that was, I wanted to do a band, too afraid to do it. Saw an opening, very uncharacteristically, kind of like inserted myself into it and had a good experience. You know, it was, and as it turned out, wasn't nearly as nerve wracking or as horrible as I thought it was going to be. It was, you know, it was very rewarding, but it wasn't until much later that I attempted to play an instrument, because I carried that, you know, all those hangups for, you know, years afterward.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. For sure. And did you, what was your, I guess, to this day, like what's your most, I guess, extensive touring experience?
Not much. I did, you know, that band was called From This Day Forward at first. Then we had to change the name because of the Equivision band, This Day Forward.
Absolutely.
And then we were called Miles Between Us, and we did an LP very, very late in the game with Think Fast and stuff. So we like got out there a little bit, but we never toured more than a week or so at a time, East Coast, and we mainly did weekends. But like I say, it was like a 4 year, you know, slog of trying to get traction with a band that, you know, probably should have broken up after 4 weeks. So there were a lot of weekends, a lot of trips, a lot of ill-advised, you know, decisions made, a lot of recordings, but no tour longer than a couple weeks, probably just 1 week or 10 days. And then around the same time, or towards the end of that, when I was in my early 20s finishing university, I did one full US tour at that time, but it wasn't with my own band. I filled in for a band who were called from Rochester. They were called The Disaster. I don't know if you ever heard of them, but they're like,
oh, yeah.
Kid Dynamite thing. We were friends with them. They had a tour lined up. Their singer couldn't do it. Singer had a job and kind of like bailed on them in the last minute. And they asked me, and so I did that. So I ended up doing, that was my one and only, I think to this day, like full US DIY 6 weeks in the van tour, which I'd always wanted to do.
Sure.
And was happy to do. And they weren't a well-known band, but they were pretty good at booking good shows. Like they had, you know, enough friends to put together a full US tour that was worth going on. Like there was a stretch with Modern Life is War, so people were at those shows. There was a stretch with Strike Anywhere in California. So those were pretty good shows. Like one of them was at the Troubadour, and then there was one at Shea Cafe, and like, so I got to play all those places. One at Gilman Street. So like I got to play those venues with that band, but that's the only time I ever did that. That was a long time ago. That was 2003. And that was like,
sure,
6 weeks doing it the old fashioned way and not even my own band.
Right. Well, I mean, it's cool that you got to, you know, have those experiences, and obviously like just the experience of touring and playing shows and stuff like that will inform what you can do, especially, you know, now with what you're doing with Milspec, where it's like, this actually dovetails into a question I was going to ask a little bit later, but the idea of like when you play shows now, which are obviously, you know, more few and far between, like, do you feel, I guess no matter what, just at least according to your personality, you probably feel the weight of the shows, but like, are they more special to you because, you know, you obviously don't play them that often?
Yeah, I think it cuts both ways. Like, you know, they are more precious because I get to do them less often, but at the same time, and I've always loved playing live. Like I've never even minded playing bad shows. Like I just like playing. There's some people who really get, you know, demoralized when they have to play or when they would have to play in front of five people or something. You know, it was never my preference to have that situation, but it never bothered me too much. I was just was able to make the best of it. So I always took to playing live. I always liked doing it, and I still do. And the opportunities are definitely more precious now. But, you know, at the same time, I'm a lot older than I used to be. So the landscape has changed. That there's enough about shows now that are different than they used to be and were for a long time that I don't quite feel the same way about them, because I just don't, like, I'm not involved in that youth culture anymore. You know, so I've kind of had to, you know, let a certain amount of it go, let a certain amount of sentimental attachment to it go, because it's just not, doesn't belong to me in the same way. And you know, they're also just like physically, you know, like I can't stay up as late. I don't, you know, I don't have enough, as much tolerance for crowds and noise and all that kind of shit. Like I'm laming out as a middle-aged person. So there's, that cuts one way, but the kind of like, the sentimental attachment that does remain cuts the other way. And like my just, you know, general fondness for playing live cuts the other way. So it probably on balance shakes out in favor of, yeah, the shows feel a little bit more special now.
Right.
Harder to make time for, but it doesn't feel the way it used to. It can't, like, I'm just, you know, it will never feel the way it felt when you're 17 or 20.
No, definitely not. It's like, yeah, you just, there are echoes that you can feel, but it, you know, it just takes on a different meaning. Something that I've really admired about the band and what you're doing is the fact that, I mean, especially with the release of the magazine that you did to accompany the last LP that you released, like, context seems like a very important part to the band. Like, not only are you trying to pull in all of these different influences and obviously create the music that you're doing, but like, you want to show your influences and, you know, show your work, so to speak. It's obviously, it's a very deliberate choice of yours. What, I guess, gives you that fuel to build the context around the band and not just obviously be like, oh, here's a record. Like, all the context is in there. Like, we want to give you more.
That's a good, it's a good question. I'm not really sure exactly what the full answer is. Like, the partial answer in the case of the zine was as a lyricist, like one of the people who writes lyrics in the band, like, I have a very elusive and kind of intertextual style. Like, I quote a lot of things and pull from a lot of things and make very direct references. Like, if I'm reading something, I'll write down passages and go back and rework them. Like, I kind of need to do that to get myself going as a lyricist. I can't go from a standing start on a blank page with just, you know, whatever's in my head organically. So I steal from the, you know, I steal from a lot of people basically, and try to steal from the best, which makes me feel self-conscious when the lyrics are actually published. So there was like the germ of that zine, the initial impulse was to give credit where it was due and to do the lyric annotation and make sure that everybody knew I wasn't going to deny that I was stealing a lot. So again, it was my own neurosis playing a big role in a decision I was making. Even though I knew, and I remember I did an interview with Fred Passaro about this, where he asked, like, doesn't it, you know, annotating your lyrics kind of demystify them? And I was like, yes, absolutely, it does. Explaining lyrics is never a good idea, but that was the trade-off. Like, we were going to, you know, we were going to like run the risk of being a little bit obnoxious by explaining our lyrics so that I could give credit where it was due to, you know, all the explicit credit to all the direct influences. So that was in terms of like providing context, that was that guilty feeling. That was the initial impulse. And then like once we decided, Dan and I were the ones who kind of, within the band who kind of cooked this idea up. Once we decided to do that, then we basically just built it from there, thinking, well, it needs to be substantial. It needs to feel substantial. Then the pandemic happened, and it was pretty clear from very early on that we weren't going to be able to tour or play on it, and that we weren't going to be able to provide offer context in that way. Which is in the usual course of things, how context is offered with the band. You play live and the audience sees, oh, that's what they dress like. That's what they look like. That's, you know, that's what their sense of humor is. That's, you know, this is how they present themselves. You know, you get all the fuller picture of the band. You get the information that you need in order to fully decide if you actually like the band or not. We weren't going to get a chance to do that. So it made sense to kind of make those representations in print and with words and with images and stuff, and by making that zine, we could show off a different side of the band. A lot of the material is a little, you know, it can be a little, there's a lot, you know, we we play around kind of like we play a dangerous game with emotionality and sentiment and sappiness in the band. I think it works most of the time. Sometimes you step over the line, but that also produces kind of a self-serious effect that I also wanted to cut against. I wanted there to be funny stuff in the zine. So, you know, we a more well-rounded impression of our personality was presented. I wanted to kind of correct for, you know, some of those tendencies to be overwrought. Like there were a whole bunch of reasons for it. And a lot of them, as you can tell by how I'm explaining it, were like motivated by self-consciousness and things sure. like that. But I think in the upshot of it, and to the extent that it worked, it did work because it felt, you know, it felt like this broader canvas was, you know, provided and a lot of context was offered. And like, I think it didn't come across as like, you know, sweaty or desperate or, you know, insecure. I think it actually, the effect was, you know, a lot more salutary than that. But sure. a lot of the motivation was, you know, self-consciousness and guilt. And,
right. You know, all good things. All good things.
43-year-old neuroses, yeah.
Yeah. I also, the idea that you've articulated this before in other interviews, but I love the fact that, like, you know, you call the band intergenerational, and, you know, you're pulling with people that are obviously younger than you, and like you're able to, you know, create this stew of different influences just based on ages alone. While I'm sure it wasn't the kind of intention to be like, all right, we got to draft some younger people to play with or whatever, I presume that's just kind of an added bonus, the fact that you can kind of come at it from different perspectives and not just, yeah. Okay.
If anybody's listening who's like 30 plus or 35 plus who wants to start a band, just go out and recruit, just chicken hawk some young guys.
Yep.
Because if you do that, you won't have to wear the fact that you're an old guy in a band. Your band won't be an old guy band if you do that. That's not what I set out to do, but that's what ended up happening. And very early on, I recognized, oh, this is great. I don't have to be in an old guy band because I have these younger guys who can kind of be the public face of it. I could just suck the adrenochrome right out of them, you know, and drink from the fountain of youth. Because at the time I was playing in an old guy band, my friend Nate, the aforementioned, had moved to Toronto, and I was playing in a straight edge band called Ancient Heads, which was kind of a goof on the fact that we were older.
Of course.
And that was, you know, that was kind of a star-crossed band, and like the fact and being in an old guy band was really fraught in ways that we hadn't expected. And it was, there were elements of it that were kind of a bummer. So, when I started jamming with Jacob, the drummer, who was a lot younger than me, and Dan and Cody and Andrew, it was, you know, I didn't realize that I was doing this, but I definitely, very early on recognized that this was an opportunity to kind of hide behind, you know, a facade of youth and not have to, you know, not have to answer for being, you know, part of the gerontocracy in punk, which is, you know, a very real thing. There are a lot of old guy bands out there right now, and I'm a part of the problem, but I don't have to like have the public reputation of having that, being part of that problem, because, you know, everybody else is of appropriate age. I'm the only one who isn't.
Right. The, like we were joking about off mic, I mean, this isn't a joke because it's the truth. Like, you know, the band is absent from social media. And maybe that's like part of working with Locking Out, is the fact that like you have to be, you know, scarce on the internet in order to, you know, put out a record. Obviously, I'm joking, but clearly that's a deliberate choice, not only for you as a person, but then, you know, the band. Is it just the fact that like, yeah, this doesn't really like not only like lean on our strengths, but it's not something that we're really horribly interested in?
Yeah, that's kind of it. Nobody ever pushed for us to have social, so we never did. I was telling somebody else about this. There was no strong push from anybody. Like, you know, the guys on in the band who do have social media accounts kind of get their, you know, whatever they get out of being on social media, they get from their personal accounts. Nobody felt the need to kind of translate that to make the band a social media phenomenon. We didn't. I was saying this to somebody else. It wasn't because we wanted to make proof a point or, you know, or enact some anonymity manifesto. We weren't trying to be mysterious guys. It just didn't seem right to be a hardcore band, especially coming out of the little, you know, like the niche that we came out of, which was like Mosh's Delight, you know, Intent, Free Spirit, Demo Core. Like that was the milieu that we were in. Almost none of those bands had social media. You weren't supposed to. It was, you know, it was kind of anathema. We kind of translated the principles to our band and then kind of just kept it up as the band kept going, even though we're not really, you know, that niche doesn't really exist anymore, or at least in its original form. And
right.
You know, whatever aversion we might have had, like kind of on principle, doesn't really apply anymore. But just because of inertia, we kept it up. You know, it would be another, like what we always say is it's not like we're immune to all of the kind of like weird social dynamics that you get caught up in on social media. Like we're on plenty of platforms that just don't happen to be social platforms. We're on Spotify, so we're always checking, you know, like peeking at those numbers. We're, you know, when an album comes out, we're like, you know, trying to do interviews like this one. We're like, we're playing the game and we're like involved in all that stuff. And if we had social accounts, that would just be, one more set of numbers to like freak out about and be, you know, to be like weird about. And it's just nice not to keep that to a minimum, because
right,
it'll take over your life.
Yeah, basically you're just telling me it's like, you know, we can't handle the attention. Like there's numbers. Like we just don't, I don't want to pay attention to more than one number. That's just too much.
Yeah. And it's not like the thirst for attention is, you know, ancient. It's, you know, it's from time immemorial. Like, you know, bands, when I was a kid, I was saying, this is the other thing I was saying to the person I was talking to, like they were just as thirsty for attention then as they are now. That's never been, it's never been otherwise. The only difference now is that, you know, the process and the set of processes, the set of tools for drawing attention and quantifying the amount you're getting have been, you know, become so much more sophisticated and rationalized that, all the bad psychology around wanting attention is just, you know, magnified by 100,000 times. Everybody knows that. And everybody in hardcore and punk has known that for a lot longer than most people. That's the funny thing about being in hardcore and punk, like all these weird social dynamics that eventually hit the mainstream tend to come to hardcore first. I'm sure you've, you know, made this point yourself. And social media, like I heard the episode, Ray, you did with Gibby.
Yes.
Makeout Club. And I think you guys talked about this, like all of this weird shit that started to happen to everybody happened to punk and hardcore and emo people first because of Makeout Club. Like we were like, you know, we were the test market. We were the,
of course. You
know, you could just see it happening. You could just see it spreading to the rest of the culture. Like I can remember when everybody really started to get on Facebook around 07, 08, I can just remember thinking, oh my God, the whole world is about to become the fucking rev board or the V9 right. board. Like we're in a lot of trouble here. Like
totally.
The thought I had wasn't quite so crystal clear, but I think a lot of us had a version of that. You're like, oh my God, everybody's going to be acting like this now. Everybody's going to be acting like online hardcore kids.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, we don't need the rush to the lamb goat comments. Okay, like let's calm down.
Right, exactly. That's exactly what we fucking got in every walk of life.
Absolutely. And now it's just like you can do lamb goat comments, obviously, on, you know, wars or political beliefs or anything else, where as opposed to, you know, this person sold out or whatever. Where it's like, oh my gosh,
we saw it all. Like I mean, all
we
this,
did
all that stuff. We saw it in like 2000, 1999. Like we saw like the way that people would act, and it used to be to your discredit if you like let yourself get sucked into it. Like you kind of had to be a little bit sheepish about, you know, when you brought up Makeout Club. That changed, you know.
Yep.
People lost their hangups about it pretty quickly, but
right,
you know, to be part of the early kind of beta social, like the beta tested social internet was to like, kind of violate certain shibboleths. You know, you were being fake. You were being, you know, you were being somebody you weren't. You were putting on a facade. You were, you know, you were doing things that you're not supposed to do, and it was going to engender behavior that was going to be untoward. You know, and that was, it's not like people didn't know what the risks were, what the downsides were, but the temptations were just too great. So everybody got involved, first with us, then with everybody else.
Yeah.
But it was so crazy to have had the front row seat.
Totally. Totally. So how does, I mean, clearly like you obviously have built a life outside of the, you know, confines of punk and hardcore, and, you know, you traveled in the world of journalism for many years. And like, how does, what you have, you know, learned and gleaned from your experience within the, you know, DIY and punk scene and stuff infiltrate your quote unquote real life? Or do you kind of separate those, you know, pretty distinctly?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't know. I think the thing that you get, or I guess maybe should get, when you're like a punk or hardcore person is, I don't know, like a you tend, most people anyway, to cultivate or at least perform a certain kind of healthy cynicism or skepticism towards, you know, institutions or common or, you know, like a conventional wisdom or whatever, you know, like just sort of the way things are that, you know, in theory should serve you well in a, if you're working in journalism, as I did for a decade or so. It's not exactly how it goes because, you know, news organizations like to think of themselves as the people who speak truth to power, but they're an institution like any other. They're a power center like any other. So that's kind of how they act. But you definitely come into it. I definitely came into it thinking, well, it'll make sense to kind of do this job or to be part of this sort of enterprise because the stated job description is to be, you know, is to be a cynic and to be a, and to be a skeptic and to be a, like a puncturer of narratives or whatever. So it's, I don't know, it was motivating early on, like as with any career or any industry or any sector that you're in for too long, there's a lot that happens that will be demoralizing or, demystifying, things like that. But, I think it was probably true that like, kind of temperamentally and philosophically, the two things were a good mix on that basis, even if, you know, the reality of journalism isn't exactly like the myth of it or the self-image of it, the self-regarding image of it.
Right. Yeah. No, I think it is interesting, like as you, to your point, because you've thought about this and as a old human within the context of punk and hardcore, like clearly it is a youth culture-based movement, but at the same time, this scene and this subculture has not existed for, you know, arguably like it's around 40 years old now. And so like there hasn't really been the ability to watch generations unfold. And so I think now you're starting to see how people, you know, for lack of a better term, like age gracefully. Of course, people can point to, you know, Henry Rollins or Ian MacKaye and be like, oh yeah, that's how you do it. And it's like, yeah, well, those are unicorns, my friend. But yeah, for you to be able to like,
helps to have made some money, you know.
Yeah,
Ian MacKaye can be above the fray and not have to reunite any band because, you know.
Of course, right.
Crass about it, you know.
No, he's getting mailbox checks on top of mailbox checks, and it's like, yeah, that's fine, and more power to him. I would rather have, you know, him be a secret millionaire than any of us.
All postage paid, though, he's still getting killed on shipping.
He's absolutely crushed on shipping. Yeah. But yeah, to your point, just the idea of like still being able to be active while not looking like some, you know, stupid cliche of yourself, but then also, you know, be a contributing member of society, whatever that may mean, you know, being able to balance all those, like it takes a lot to be able to still pursue the passions while also obviously being a quote unquote normal person.
Yeah. That kind of, you can kind of abstract that out to the whole community too, for lack of a better word. Like it's sort of a problem on the individual basis, but it's also a problem for the whole scene or whatever, the whole subculture. Like it's the whole subculture is aging and trying to contend with, you know, being older and trying to contend with what happens when you get older. Like, you know, the thrill can be gone when you get older. You start to repeat yourself when you're older. You get hardened. You're less idealistic and romantic when you're older. Like the kind of scene at large is dealing with all these things. Like it's everybody within it is, a lot of people within, not everybody, like people our age are aging within it, but the thing itself is aging, and the two the individual level and the community-wide level kind of interact with each other in interesting ways.
Oh, absolutely. No, I agree.
You know, like it's, there are ways in which this, you know, punk and hardcore feel really decadent and tired. And then there are other ways where it's the opposite, where it does, you know, like there's all kinds, there's as much excitement around it and as much, especially among young people, as there ever was, as much genuine excitement and energy, which is really reassuring. But, you know, on other fronts, you know, it seems, especially from the point of view of somebody who's older, like it's the thing can be out of gas, and it could depend on the day. Like one day it'll feel like it's out of gas, and the next day you'll be completely reinvigorated. But it's not, you know, the baby is, you know, the baby is no longer cute. Like they had it pegged 40 years ago.
Right. You know,
it's novelty and youth and being the new thing will only take you so far. And nobody who starts something like this or gets involved with something like this thinks they're still going to be doing it decades later. So when you still are. It can be, you know, it can be really demoralizing, or it can also be really comforting. It can be like a source of comfort and stability and continuity in your life. And it can also feel like you're wasting your time. Like it's, I think a lot of people who are involved, especially older people, are really, really ambivalent about it, but they just can't quit it. It's like me with sports, can't quit it.
Yeah. Totally. You're like, I'm always going to root for the home sports team or whatever. Yeah. It's there's certain things you can't quit. And that, you know, that is a positive thing because there are still, you know, selfishly on my end of things, I can listen to a new Mil-Spec record and be like, thank God you guys are a band. Of course. Thank God. I'm so glad.
That's sweet of you to say. Thank you.
Yeah, of course. Well, Matt, I very much appreciate the time and thank you for letting me punish you and go in these philosophical directions.
Yeah, no, it was my pleasure, Ray. I was really happy to tell the world about this very exciting, amazing core record called Marathon that I just want the whole world to hear.
What a good pitch man you are, Matt.
There you have it. That was Matt from the awesome band Mil-Spec. Please check them out, because if you like anything that is hardcore related, whether that's emotional hardcore, DC hardcore, whatever you want to call it, that is what they deliver. And Mil-Spec released a record called Marathon that is, it's so flipping good. So anyways, thank you very much, Matt, for being gracious with your time and hanging out with me. Next week is the often anticipated fabled best of 2023 podcast. And when I say fabled, it's just because me and my friend Joey and my friend Jeremy have been doing this for many, many years. And we just love talking about records, and that's what we do. So we walk through our top 10 records of the year, and it gives a lot of people some, you know, pointers on records that they should check out if they have not themselves. So that's what we got next week. Until then, please be safe, everybody.
The show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Trust me in saying that no matter who you are, mental health challenges can affect you, and how you manage them can make all of the difference. That's why everyone should have access to mental health support that meets them where they are and helps them get through. BetterHelp provides online therapy on your schedule. It's flexible, simple to use, and more affordable than in-person therapy. Connect with a licensed therapist selected just for you. Learn more at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.